Hello, everybody. My name is Erica, and for those of you that I have never met in person, I started coming to Brightway during the pandemic when it was all online, and then as soon as we opened back up in late 2021, I started coming in person, and I took Jukai last year. So this is my first talk, and this is the first time I've led any kind of discussion since I was in college. We had to like take turns being the teacher's assistant for a class, and I didn't know what to do, so I just brought like desserts for everybody so everybody would like my talk. And so if I could do it, I would bring you all desserts. But I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for having me. And I just wanted to acknowledge that it is 8 p.m. here, which means that on the East Coast, it is 11 p.m. And I think we have people that are on even later, perhaps. Benny, what time is it where you are? Where are you?
6 a.m.
6 a.m. So it's already tomorrow where you are. So thank you, everybody, for joining. And today we are going to talk about do not be mean with Dharma or wealth. So, as it says in our study book, in the genuine all-pervading Dharma, being jealous of nothing is the precept of not being mean with Dharma or wealth. One phrase, one verse, that is the 10,000 things in 100 grasses. One Dharma, one realization, that is all Buddhas and Dharma ancestors. From the beginning, not one thing has been begrudged. And the reason I chose this particular precept is because I really had no idea what it meant. It's like, okay, it doesn't make that much sense to me. It's not as straightforward as something as, do not kill. And so I was just really curious to dig into it and figure out what exactly does this mean. One of the resources that we have here is the Dharmarain Precept Study Book. And so they kind of broke that down. And they, according to them, in the genuine all-pervading Dharma indicates that there can be no lack. So, this precept is about stinginess, right? About having something and not sharing it. Basically there is no lack. So right from there, it's an illusion. One phrase, one verse refers to giving just a phrase or a verse. Dogen says that this is the same as the 10,000 things, which means that grand gestures are rarely necessary. From the beginning, not one thing has been begrudged, corresponds to all pervading. So one indicates no lack throughout space, and the other indicates no lack throughout time. So basically, there's never been any kind of lack throughout time and space. All of that we construe as lack is basically just a human construct. So, to start this, I wanted to kind of look at some of the things that might be coloring our view of this precept. So, in college, I was an English major, and in addition to, preparing me to get like really low-paying work, the other thing that you learn as an English major is how to look at the context of things. So, we didn't just read a book, we would also be looking at in what time period was this author living? What were the larger cultural and social issues going on at the time? And so I thought we could look at the context of what we as, Western converts of Buddhism look at this as. So first I kind of dug into what Christianity tells us about not just scarcity, but also about need. So, you know, I found that, you know, scarcity and greed really are two sides of the same coin, because one is about not sharing what you have, and the other side of it is taking more than you need. So in the Book of Mark, it says, a rich young man comes up to Jesus and asks him how to inherit eternal life. Jesus tells the young man to keep God's commandments, which the man quickly claims to have kept. Why do I still lack? He asks. And then Jesus answered, if you want to be perfect, go sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. The disciples were astonished at his words, but Jesus answered again and said unto them, how hard it is for them to trust in riches, those that trust in riches, to enter the kingdom of God. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. So probably any of us who grew up with Christianity have heard this before. I also, you know, thought about the seven deadly sins, which Leah had mentioned last week. And so, you know, the seven deadly sins are they're basically a group of vices within Christian teachings. And they're not actually directly mentioned in the Bible, but there are parallels with things that God is said to dislike. So according to the standard list, one of them is greed, and the others are pride, wrath, envy, lust, gluttony, and sloth. And what's kind of interesting about them is that for each vice, there is a corresponding virtue. So, you know, if greed is a vice, the virtue that corresponds with it is charity. So that's part of what we're going to be talking about tonight, is charity, generosity, and what that looks like from a Buddhist perspective. So, you know, that's what Christianity, or, you know, our Western kind of mindset has told us that we're supposed to think about generosity or greed. But then I feel like it's very contradictory to what larger American culture tells us about greed and generosity and what we owe to other people, because, you know, we are part of a capitalist society, and that basically runs on greed and profit. So I just wanted to share a 1 minute clip from a movie that probably many of you will recognize, from 1987. It's a movie called Wall Street. And so Mick, if you could please share that video.
I am not a destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
So, that is a little bit of a different message than what we hear from Christianity. Interestingly, the screenplay for this movie was originally called Greed. And then I guess they thought that that was too obvious, and they changed the name to Wall Street. Also, I researched, and people tell Michael Douglas all the time that they went into Wall Street to be just like this character. to be like Gordon Gekko. So even though he's supposed to be the bad guy of the movie, that's actually not the way a lot of people have interpreted it. They see him as a hero or an anti-hero. So, you know, this character that he played, Gordon Gekko, was based on several prominent Wall Street men who all of them eventually went to jail for insider trading. But in addition, they all served incredibly short sentences and then were back out in capitalist society. And so many people since then, you know, like Jeff Skilling from Enron, Bernie Madoff, Martha Stewart, you know, they have all gone to jail for conspiracy, obstruction, fraud, and money laundering. These were all people who did not need more money. You know, they were already wealthy beyond imagination, but it wasn't enough for them. So not only were they not generous with what they had, they just kept on taking. And their crimes, you know, it wasn't just about themselves. It cost investors billions of dollars, and it made, you know, tens of thousands of people lose their jobs. So my point with this is just that, you know, stinginess and greed may seem like it's just something that little that we're doing that doesn't have a big effect, but it is affecting all of us on a large scale in every single aspect of our lives, and especially the choices of people who are in power. Another thing I wanted to mention about, you know, just how societally we're shaped by this is there's something called the myth of scarcity. So, you know, you can wonder why, as Michael Douglas was saying, greed is good. Why hasn't this philosophy worked in real life? And it's, I mean, the US has never actually been a free market. The government has always intervened through spending and tax policies. And what I find really sad is that we have the largest GDP. The US has the largest GDP of the entire world, but we are still in debt. We are still in debt, 121% of our national economy. And so we actually don't know as a society how to give less than we take. It's not the way that we function as a society. So, you know, this idea of scarcity, it's that there isn't enough to go around, so somebody is going to have to go without. I came across a blogger named Dr. Susan Rosenthal, who blogs about capitalism, and she said, when production is not sufficiently profitable, the capitalist class invest in the stock market and finance, and real estate, and whatever might bring a profit, regardless of whether anything is actually produced. The hunger for profit leads to increasingly risky investments and speculative bubbles. When these bubbles inevitably burst, financial institutions are left holding billions of dollars in bad debt. So the economic forms of consumerism and capitalism, they condition us as consumers. They promote us this idea of individualism, right? It's everybody out for themselves. It's us against everyone else. And that really disconnects us from a sense of community. And so to help generate, you know, more of a sense of our interdependence, you know, we really need to be more aware of the fact that what's ours isn't just ours, you know, and our choices to share or not to share that with other people are going to have an effect, not just on other people, but also on us as well. So before I go on to what the Buddha has to say about that, I just wanted to see if anybody had anything to comment on about what we covered so far.
I think I really appreciate what you said about, I mean, we're constantly being made to feel like an individual. I feel like advertising, oh, you know, you're so unique, look at you, like, and it doesn't sound like a bad thing. Like, even as a child, I was told like, oh, you're so unique, that's such a good thing. But it's like, I do see how this individualism is negative in that way of like, creating like, oh, me, I need all of this. And then all of a sudden you have this reputation that you have to uphold, and that, you know, your money and all of that stuff. And it just leads on this really slippery slope. And culturally, it's like a problem for us. And it's the American dream kind of, but yeah.
Yeah. It's keeping up with the Joneses. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mick, did you have something?
Yeah, I really like the way that you've kind of framed this in terms of the way that, like, it's almost things that we don't recognize day to day that are like large factors in our lives that are kind of like woven into this. And that's some of the stuff that I find really difficult to practice with, because it's hard. Like, I mean, you know, whatever you want to say about like greed or money, but like, I got to buy groceries for my family. I have to participate in the society. And, you know, we are sort of like conditioned in this hyper individualistic way to kind of like, yeah, to like almost like what Gordon Gekko was saying, like we're all these little like greed, like robots that are out there fighting each other, because that's the way our society has decided it wants to function. And it's really hard now that I'm kind of like reframing this precept. It's really interesting to think about what to do. I don't know.
Yeah, I find it hard with my kids, you know, because I'll go into a store with them and they'll just get this glazed look on their faces, and they're like, I want to buy something, you know, and they don't even care what it is. It doesn't matter to them. They're not going to leave until they have some kind of a toy or something that they will forget about the minute that we leave the store, and it's going to end up in the trash, you know? And so it is a delicate balance between buying them things that they need and things that will somehow be enriching to their lives and not falling into this sort of consumer trap. So.
I love how you have kicked this off. I've learned a lot, and I love the connection to the movie. What I'm about to say is not an original idea. I don't know if I got it from the movie or if I got it from somewhere else around the time of the late 80s. But you were saying that some of these people who had broken the law were already so phenomenally wealthy that they didn't need to break the law to get more. But it is as though, I think that's something that any of us can do with a Buddhist teaching or with one of these precepts, and that is, we get distracted and we forget what we're here about and what we're trying to do. And I have heard it said that it's not so much about getting more money because they want more money. It's because money is the scorecard, mm-hmm, and they're playing a game.
It is. It's a game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're so involved in they are so involved in keeping score and getting a higher and higher score that they can't notice that their neighbor has had a terrible accident, has lost his job, and can't put his kid through college. And there are many, many other horrible stories like that. And so I will be quiet because I want to hear what else you have to say. But to me, it's a lot about the attention, I think, that we're going to be bringing to this precept and to our practice in general.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to talk then about what Buddha says about this, as well as what our particular lineage says about this. So I grew up Catholic, and so there's Catholic charities, right? And I was always wondering, why is there no like Buddhist charities? And I actually found out there is. There's an organization, a Buddhist humanitarian organization called Zuji. And what they say about generosity is that the Buddha teaches us that to have blessings, we must create blessings. This is the law of karma. If people have this concept, they'll be able to better make use of their wealth. Lacking this concept may bring much misery. The Buddha teaches us that we cannot bring material wealth with us to our next life. We can only make use of it in this life. With this concept in mind, let us seize every moment to create blessings. So in Buddhism, there's this word called dana, and dana means generosity or free will offering, which follows, you know, the ancient practice of the Buddhist lineage where teachings are offered freely. So dating back to the time of the Buddha, the teachings are given freely since they are considered beyond monetary value. There has always existed an interdependence between those who offer teachings and those who receive them. And that is symbolized in the daily alms round of Buddhist monastics who rely on the generosity of lay people for support in order to continue their spiritual life. And in kind, the monastics devote their time to preserving and practicing the teachings. And so this relationship of mutual giving embodies a sacred contract that enlivens the teachings and aims at making it a more pure transmission. So according to the Buddha, sharing whatever we have, whether it's money, time, work, nurture, or resources, is one of the central pillars of having a spiritual life. In the act of giving, we develop our ability to let go and cultivate a culture of caring. An act of generosity can be spontaneous or a more considered practice of supporting that which we are already aligned with. And it's generosity is also something that undermines grasping and helps us move beyond the self in a way that we can connect and be mutually supportive with others. And so, you know, you may think, okay, that's great. All I got to do is like give some money or some time and I'm good. But it gets a little more nuanced than that, of course. And so in terms of the kinds of things that we should give, according to Thubten Chodron, who is a Tibetan Buddhist monk, there are actually three different kinds of giving. So there's the giving of material aid. The second is the giving of protection from fear. And then the third is the giving of dharma. So giving material aid means being wise and realistic in our giving. So I take that to mean like not actually giving more than you're able to give. Giving without pride, so not being boastful that you're giving, and then giving without any expectation of return, just giving freely. Giving from the protection from fear is not giving things obtained by wrong livelihood. So if you stole a candy bar and then you gave it to your friend, that would not be a good kind of giving. Giving good quality items, so not giving somebody something that's just going to fall apart. And then the act of giving frees us from fear itself and miserliness, which is, you know, the excessive desire to save money. And then, so the giving of Dharma, you know, as we know it, it's not just the teaching of Buddhism, but it's truth with a capital T. It's the larger truth that goes even beyond Buddhism. So that, you know, can be many different things. It can be actually teaching the Dharma. It can be giving teachings on texts, leading a meditation. It can just be listening to your friend, talking over a problem. And so all of these different things can be considered giving the Dharma. So, you know, not all of us are made out of money. So if you can't give money, what else can you give? Tenzin Rinpoche, who's again a Tibetan monk, says, be a role model, give kindness and love, look for opportunities to give without attachment. So in terms of what our Zen lineage specifically says about this, Domyo had a podcast in 2017 on the middle way between being self-centered or being a do-gooder. And in it, she said, it also matters that you interact with others so they have a chance to experience benefit from what you do. What's important is to share ourselves. After all, that's one of our precepts as well. Do not be mean. The Dharma, well, share understanding, give freely of self. Many of us neglect to do this generously because we suffer from low self-esteem and we assume that nobody really wants what we have to share, or that we don't have anything of value to share, which, you know, I think, at least for me, that's definitely true. And so when I was, you know, preparing this talk, I was actually having some trouble finding texts that were helping me make sense of this particular precept. And I'm part of the practice intensive group, and Mick mentioned this really great book called Opening to Oneness. Yes, thank you. And so this book is written by Nancy Mujo Baker, who is a Soto Zen teacher in New York. And so the way that she explains this particular precept about not being stingy is, she says, we are stingy with anything that we hold on to, any person, any situation, anything that's going on in us that we are unwilling to open to. We are stingy when we're not fully participating in what's happening here and now. Imagine wholeheartedly being here for whatever it is, a class, a meeting, a dinner, gardening, a fretting baby. We are stingy when we're withholding anything about the truth of where we are. We are stingy when we don't take risks. We are stingy when we're not compassionate. We are stingy with our tears, with kind words, with open-heartedness, with open-mindedness. And she says one of the things that we're stingy with is 100%, with the idea of doing, just doing something 100%. She says, imagine loving 100%. Imagine acknowledging someone 100%. With no thought of getting something in return. We're stingy with the truth of what's really going on in us, what we really want. We hold on to the truth, hold it back, withhold it. We play our cards close to the chest, covering our heart. We also try to turn a profit and practice to get something from our practice. We try to get better. We try to get enlightenment. We try to get seen for doing our practice right. Okay, Dennis, I won't tell you how it ends. And what are we being stingy with here? Wholehearted surrender to the present moment is what we're being stingy with, or to what is. Think how stingy we are with doubt. Think how tightly we hold on. We also imagine that in practicing, what we will get is going to be ours, which is, of course, the greatest delusion of all. So what else are we stingy with? We hold on to security, self-images, pain, suffering, unwillingness to suffer, being right, truth, love, being a victim, need for recognition, time, praise. Think of how we hang on to all of these different things. We don't give them away. We don't share them. And one of the important things that we're stingy with is gratitude. So think of the gratitude expressed and grace before meals. The Zen version begins, 72 labors brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. Are we wholehearted in knowing that and expressing our gratitude, or are we stingy? And we can be stingy in addition with receiving gratitude and with receiving praise from other people. Consider what Dogen has to say about the eight precepts. One phrase, one verse, 10,000 forms, 100 grasses, one dharma, one realization, all Buddhas, all teachers. Since the beginning, there has never been being stingy. What he's talking about is ultimate reality, the absolute, the faceless one. There's nothing stingy about the one. There can't be, because there's nothing outside it. Stinginess implies separation, but there is no separation here. When it comes to this world of multiplicity, it is manifested over and over and over again from moment to moment. There's nothing stingy there. It is a gift given to us constantly, alive, pulsating. What about my life? What about myself? To not be stingy with my life, with myself, is to fully express myself at every moment, fully express everything that I am. Not being stingy with one's life, with oneself, with this precious short gift we've been given, is often associated with voice, with finding one's voice. So everything preaches the Dharma, nuclear waste, skunks, flowers, grass, and does so fully and completely. What is not stingy. There's nothing but held. So how do we actually work with all of this? According to Nancy Mujo Baker, the first thing is not to be stingy in discovering who we are in relation to stinginess. Where am I stingy about what, with whom? We need to ask, can we take a good neutral look at ourselves without any preferences? Can we feel safe enough, not stingy enough, to express who we are, where we are to another? Coming to terms with who I am in relation to stinginess and doing so with no judgment is one thing, but being not stingy enough to place my stinginess right out on the table before others takes the practice even deeper. So that was my talk. And I guess since there's only 20 minutes left, I'll just open it up to general discussion, see if anybody had any feedback on that, or if you just want to, you know, ruminate on the question about what am I stingy with and what am I afraid of losing if I give up that stinginess. Yeah, Leah.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that stinginess to me is connected to fear. Because if you think about the future too much, which is totally me, and you think, well, something might happen, so I better have this thing, or I better have this money or something like that. It's sort of like, it reminds me of earlier generations that have been through wars or chaos or like the depression or something like that, when they're just gonna buy two toasters because one toaster may break and then you need the second toaster. Or, you know what I'm saying? It's just like you need to sort of stack up. It's almost like insurance. Like you need to make sure to have, you know, or hoarding, like in, to varying degrees, is also sometimes connected to fear that you won't have something or that it's going to be taken away or something like that. So anyway, that's all I really have now. The fear is a part for me.
Yeah, definitely fear seemed to be a big part of this. I guess it is with all of the precepts, but this one in particular, there's a lot of, stinginess is essentially grasping, right? It's just holding on tighter than you need to. And that really, all of that goes back to fear. So Mick.
Yeah, I've really been thinking about that, the idea of giving freely of self, and kind of like, I guess in practicing with it, when I do things that I view as a kindness, when I really think like, am I giving freely of myself, I have kind of like tried to pause and ask myself, like, is this a gift that I'm giving? Or do I have some future version of myself where, you know, my kid is glad that I put his shoes in the shoe rack, or my wife is happy that I did the dishes? Or because if I want that kind of emotional response from the people around me, then it's not really a gift. That's a transaction. And it pops up like way more than I thought it would. Just sort of like these like small little acts that you do, and just sort of automatically in my mind, it's like I'm banking good like brownie points or something, and somebody's going to be happy with me, and I'm going to get somebody's approval. And it's really hard to kind of disentangle generosity from this sort of like stinginess. And it's like you had mentioned in the book that like there's like stinginess in wanting enlightenment, stinginess in wanting something out of practice. And it's so tricky because I think we're all here to like be better people. And that's a great thing to like want, but it's also like wanting something. And I don't know. That's very, very tricky for me. I don't know how to navigate that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is tricky because we're not doing this for no reason. Obviously we're all dedicating our time and our efforts for something, but it's, you know, can we do that and still let go of any expectation of what's going to happen, or, you know, that we somehow deserve something out of this practice? So, yeah.
Go ahead. You sure? Yeah. I really appreciate the way you open this up when you're talking about capitalism. Because when I did this talk last year, the first version of this talk was an anti-capitalist manifesto. Like, I made it weird. It was too much. And I think that you spoke about it so gracefully, and it was really, really well done.
Well, there's no way to cover this precept without it being anti-capitalist,
right? Exactly.
That's okay.
Yeah. And thinking about things that I'm stingy with, an example came to mind in past, you know, romantic relationships, actually being stingy with somebody else's time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want to spend time with me? Mm-hmm. and realizing that I could actually be stingy, like, for other people, like, it's crazy how far and wide this applies.
Yeah it's pretty far reaching. And you know, like we were talking about it, I mean, really most of our interactions with people are transactional, and the in of the self, that's not really a bad thing. That's what we have to do to function in society. But, you know, it's also like, it sort of takes you out of the moment and of just recognizing that you're interacting with another human being, and that they, you know, they are deserving of your time and your presence. And like Nancy Mujo Baker said, of just giving 100%. And we're not even really trained to do that as people. We're just trained to like say what you're supposed to say and just leave it at that and move on. And so I think that practicing this is actually quite radical. So yeah, Benny.
Thank you. I wanted to share two things about this stinginess. And I love the word. As a German, the stinginess as a sound is just, it's funny. But it's another thing. Yes, when I started long traveling, you know, for a long time, and I used to live in Germany all my life. So, and if you are in Germany, you know, and you meet people you don't know, maybe while hiking in the forest or at the beach or something, it's always like a pretty big distance between these people. You know, it takes some time. When you just go there to somebody and say, hey, how are you? Do you want a cup of tea maybe? Then they would say, what the fuck? What's wrong with you? This is way too close and I don't want a fucking tea from you. You know, like they would think, what's wrong? What does this guy want for the tea? Why is he offering me a tea? Because it's just not what happens normally. You know, maybe on a village or something like this. And when I then started the traveling, especially in remote regions of some mountains, maybe in Greece or Albania or something, and it occurs to me that the people seem to be less stingy when they have less. So at a really small village, you know, like an old couple I'm driving through, they are like with their whatever, I think they had a goat, herd of goats, a group of goats there. And then I had to stop and they came to the car and just said, how are you? Do you want to, you know, like, they did not speak German or English, but they were like, do you want something, a tea or something? You know, that they are just offering it. And this happens so much. Yeah, and this is, I really learned to be not stingy and open to just share things with people. And every time now people are passing by when I'm living on the beach in the car and they are like close to the car, I'm saying, okay, do you want to have a cup of tea? And some nuts or fruits, and it really happens, you know? And this is really a bounding thing, just to break this initial barrier. This is the first thing. And the second thing I recognized in the last weeks is the stinginess of giving love to other people. This I found very interesting as well. You know, like what you said, like a transactional mindset, that you want to have something back. You give love to somebody or tell this person even that you love him, her, or whatever gender. And then you want to have it back, you know? And this is a crazy thing because money, okay, it's an amount or on a bank deposit or whatever, but this love thing is infinite. It even makes less sense for me than the stinginess with the money. Thank you.
Yeah, that's interesting that you talk about, you know, when people have less, they're more willing to share sometimes because, my dad is from Mexico. I grew up going there as a kid. And, you know, I was very struck by the fact that even though people were not as wealthy as they were in the US, they were so much more generous with each other. And I you know, I've been fed all these American ideas about like, oh, poor people are so unhappy. And it's like, I don't really see that. They seem like, I mean, certainly, yeah, in some ways, but they also just seem so much more generous, you know, with each other. And just, it's just, yeah, it's, I guess when you don't have as much, you don't feel the need to hold on so tight. And my dad is actually on this call too. Dad, do you want to say anything else about that?
Let's see. It's not, I'm just a visitor for this group or with this group, but I have enjoyed what's been shared today. And, you know, a passage that comes to mind is when there's this this lady that went to the temple and left, can't remember if it was 3 coins, versus a Pharisee that left lots of money on the temple. And the way the system worked was such that when you would give that donation, those coins would create noise, if you will. And so people would be very impressed with some of the people that would come and give that much money. And Jesus said, actually, that widow that gave that last coin gave more than everybody else, because she gave from what she needed. The others gave from what was disposable, excess for them. So what Erica says is what I saw in my childhood as well. When you see people that don't have all that much and know what it is like to be lacking, that when they see someone that is in dire need, they're the first ones to come to the rescue, more so than some of us, myself included. So anyway, something that we need to grow and try to get detached from, because ultimately we're not taking any of it to the next life either. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Jeannie.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has really been a great talk, and I like all the information and how you've shared it. I have a couple of comments. One, I really enjoyed Benny's comments about, you know, people and just opening up and reaching out, because that's something that I've been trying to do this year, just in little ways. And one of the things that I've learned is when somebody asks me if they can help me, or if I want to, you know, partake of something, a way that I can be generous actually is to say yes, rather than be like, oh, no, you know, because I feel like, oh, I can't return the favor or what have you. I have all these ideas in my mind. So I just love that. It's a sense of openness. And that leads me to my second comment, which is something that I've been meditating on for a few months, is death and dying. And I remember something that Pema Chodron said one time, because death is certain and the time of death is uncertain, what is the most important thing? And while I may not always readily be able to answer that, like have some great wise answer to that, when I ask myself that, what it does promote is a sense of openness. And your whole list of things, or the list from the book about stinginess, I'm like, oh God, I can relate to all of those things, you know? And that's a sense of contraction, of really of a closing in. So if I just leave all the judgments out of it for myself and others and just go to the feeling of just like contraction or openness, to just try to walk through life that way and let, you know, let the important things come and learn to receive as well as give, just interactions or goods or services. So I really appreciate this talk. It was really, really helpful for me. And thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Can I just say one
more? Yeah, is there anybody else? Any other? I don't think there's anyone else right now.
I just wanted to say that so many wonderful things have been shared. You know, this is one of those precepts. And so many of them are like this for me. We read the Kyoji Kaimon every Tuesday evening, and it's long, and now we're getting through this precept, and yeah, I get it, and we go on to the next one. And yet, when you stop and zero in on one, they are so rich. And I've heard such wonderful things. The one thing I want, two things I wanted to add, and one is that I think so much of this depends on where you are in life, what you're working on in your practice, whatever kind of habit energy you have that's forming attitudes. In my own personal experience in my house, it is only my husband and myself, but nothing works better than a household that hums along. And I can't imagine what it's like when you have two little children or more. But to know that I can count on Dwayne to empty the dishwasher, to know that I can count on him to take out the garbage and other little things he does around the house, and he can count on me for the certain things that I do. I really don't think, unless I'm kidding myself, I really don't think in my house that we are doing any of that in a transactional way. Mm-hmm. It is simply, this is what we do. The other thing I wanted to go back to, and you had some deeper meaning in this paragraph than I have ever given it, because I just let it wash over me, but I do love it. And it's the Dogen commentary. And since I don't have my glasses with me, I can't read it very well, but the last sentence is, from the beginning, not one thing has been begrudged. From the very beginning. I mean, this kind of chokes me up just a little bit. From the very beginning, the Buddha and the ancestors, they've not left anything out. They're giving it all. Mm-hmm. They're giving it all to us. All we have to do is sit and let it wash over us, and take what we can, take what we have the capacity to do, and work with it. And I just think that is such a loving approach that they have taken, yeah, for our sakes.
That's, yeah, all.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is. It's just a very hopeful precept. I think it's basically saying that the universe has your back, and you know, there's to be stingy is an illusion, a delusion, because there is no separation anyway. And so, this was a very interesting one to delve into for me. So, all right, well, I think we're at time. So we dedicate the merit of the Sangha discussion to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth.
All Buddhas, throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, bhava, prajna, paramita.
Thank you, Erica. Thank you, guys.